This is an ABC podcast.
You're listening to The Country Hour on ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
Hi, welcome to The Country Hour. I'm Cassie Huff. We're not far off autumn. Farmers are looking pretty seriously now at what they're going to sow this year. Wheat is obviously this state's main winter crop, but today we're going to catch up with one of the pioneers of no-till farming about where he thinks grain production is going in this country.
It's a team game. We need to look at Australia and say, this team, how are we going to take this team forward? Because I think we're heading to be playing the wrong game. I think we've got health foods, we've got pharmaceuticals. What can we do in Australia? What can we do if we can't compete with wheat?
He's got some interesting ideas, more on that soon, and some important information you don't want to miss if you're involved in livestock, and that's to do with changes, or possible changes, to loading ramps. That's coming up in the next 10 minutes. We'll also hear some industry reactions to the news Equinor won't go ahead with its plans to drill in the Bight. First, though, we're going to head down to the southeast, and it's no secret the lobster industry has been hit hard by the coronavirus outbreak. The state government is in talks with the industry about how to overcome some of the challenges of the virus fallout, including what to do with uncaught fishing quota and alternative markets. But it seems like they're still holding out for the Chinese market and the premium they're willing to pay. And there won't be much change when it comes to domestic sales. Bridget Herman reports.
South Australia's rock lobster industry has met with the Minister for Trade, David Ridgway, to discuss how to move forward from the impacts of coronavirus. Minister Ridgway says fisheries will go through all the options on the table and decide in coming weeks.
Well, some of the options are to roll the quota over. It's my understanding some is to allow fishing during the winter. And I know there's been some discussion around releasing lobsters from vessels back into the water. And that's really a matter for PIRZA to deal with around biosecurity. So it's not a matter for me to be involved in.
But he says he's unsure if a change in supply will impact on prices.
It depends on the coronavirus. So clearly the demand, China's the biggest demand for the lobsters, southern rock lobsters. So it is very hard to see when the coronavirus will return to normal. I guess that's the thing we're looking for. There is some demand, but certainly not the demand that we would normally see because of China's certainly their premium market, especially over the recent Chinese New Year period. So we're not quite sure when it will return to normal, but it's really a matter for a little bit of wait and see.
With the drop in the Chinese market currently leaving a gap, is there more room for the domestic market? Minister Ridgway says it's an issue for the industry to decide on.
My department's been looking for other markets in Malaysia and Japan and Singapore for their lobsters, and there are some markets available, but they don't pay the premium that the Chinese have been paying. So that's a real challenge for the industry, and that's something they're going to need to work through through the rest of this season and in future seasons.
Minister for Trade, David Ridgway. Andrew Ferguson is a lobster processor who attended the meeting. He says the domestic market has always been there.
There's a lot of volume in the fishery, and obviously the domestic market takes some of the volume. But, you know, there's a range of other issues. There's a whole lot of different sizes that have to go to different markets. And, you know, it is an expensive process to keep fisheries sustainable, which keeps, you know, we've got sustainable fisheries. It comes at a cost. So the price point is an issue. And, you know, we have many fisheries around the world that are fished out in the lobster sector. And that sort of creates a market for us in China, obviously. We have focused on the local market. The local market is there, but we need to be able to spread the market across for many range of reasons.
He thinks it's too early to suggest whether the industry should take a price hit.
Because, you know, like I said, we've got not a lot of quota to go for this season, and, you know, China is about to move into a very warm summer, and we'd hope that the virus sort of dissipates. I think we need to have these discussions, which we had last night. Very, very good discussion with the processing sector and some key people in the management committees. But I think it's a bit early to say, really.
That was lobster processor Andrew Ferguson ending Bridget Herman's report. I think there's a lot of excitement that maybe local lobster would become more affordable, but by the sounds of that, I think we'll still be shelling out quite a bit for South Australian lobster. We're going to head from the sea to the paddock now, and if you're in wheat, if you're growing wheat, it might be time to consider growing something else. That's according to West Australian farmer and innovator Ray Harrington, who is famous for being one of Australia's pioneers of no-till farming and the Harrington Seed Destroyer. Mr. Harrington was in South Australia talking about the future of ag and says those in wheat need to consider their future.
Wheat in Australia is such a crucial part of our system. I worry about wheat. I follow Chicago very closely. I reckon I've followed it for 35 years. It's average $5 US a bushel. It's only $5.40 odd today. I worry with us competing on the global scene with wheat. I really do, with the former Soviet Union, with Ukraine, South America, and we're still getting the same price, and the cost price squeeze is going to squeeze us out of wheat, and I think we need to really be looking at trying to replace it, and that's going to be a huge challenge.
And I think you were saying when we were talking in there before that it's been, you estimated that the price was generally about $5 a bushel. And it had been that way for the past 50 years that you've been in the industry.
30 years I've followed Chicago. So that's about been the... And it's varied from $2 to $13, and it sort of stayed at $5. I thought it was going to $6, but it just won't get up there because of the production coming out of the former Soviet Union. I think the numbers are they used to import about 12 million tonne, and I think they're exporting anywhere up to 45 million tonne. Now, that's a huge turnaround, and you look at the global scene, and Ukraine's cranking up. So I just worry about it. I think we need to look to the future and get ready to try and change and not just get caught with their pants down, for want of a better word.
What could people do to prepare for this?
The world is health conscious. We've got to look at trying to start growing crop from our beautiful clean green Australia. Try and see if we can actually help the world with these food crops. You know, the omega-3 crops, canola's got omega-3, and I saw one the other day, it was another plant crop that's got omega-3 in, trying to do something with flax, where flax oil, now the CSIRO said it's got a better health food properties than fish oil. Flax is sustainable. I don't believe fish oil is sustainable. I think we've got to try and look at, I'm sure all our wonderful CSIRO and all our researchers are certainly look at that, but it's still got to bring us the dollars per hectare so we remain viable.
So you think that more farmers need to, I suppose, look at ways to select the products that can be marketed better as well?
It'll be marketing. We'll need all the agronomists. We'll need all the scientists. It's a team game. We need to look at Australia and say, this team, how are we going to take this team forward? Because I think we're heading to be playing the wrong game. I think we've got health foods, we've got pharmaceuticals. What can we do in Australia? What can we do if we can't compete with wheat? And that's my concern is, if we can't compete with the wheat market, wheat's such a big percentage, what can we actually do? We need to stir the imagination of our researchers, our scientists, to give us a hand to be ready if wheat does the wrong thing for us. And I'm 50% chance being right, but let's be ready.
So you think that perhaps if someone is out there listening to this and wheat is a big part of their program, as it is for a lot of people, should they be looking at ways to... You think that maybe it would be a good idea to start thinking about getting away from wheat and looking into other things?
Not think about it. Let's start talking about it. Let's start talk to the agronomists, our researchers, our GRDC. Let's start talking about it, because I fear that I can see this writing on the wall. One of the things I want to say is I've been privileged to run around the world and what have you, and I'm over here doing some conferences. We Australian farmers... Seriously, we are so far out there in adopting new technology and working with our scientists. It's all a team. Working with our scientists and our people, don't talk to me about regenerative agriculture. Don't try and shove regenerative agriculture down my neck. We've been doing it. We've been building that for 30 years. We're already where regenerative agriculture is talking about now. Show me, tell me something you want improved in agriculture. You know, our soil, how we've looked after our soil. We've improved the pH. We've improved a whole lot of things. And we're just not sitting on it, using it and abusing it. We're improving it all the time. And guess what? The farmers have actually paid for all that. We have not had subsidies. So I'm proud to be an Aussie farmer in amongst Aussie farmers.
Farmer and innovator Ray Harrington there speaking to Lucas Forbes. And it is remarkable just how far and wide that Harrington Seed Destroyer is now being used right across the world. He certainly has made an impact on the industry. I'm interested, though, if you're looking at alternative crops this year, whether there are perhaps flaxseed option that he mentioned there or other crops that you might be considering for this year's winter crop. You can text in on 0467 922 891. This is the Country Hour and it is 16 minutes past 12.
You're listening to the Country Hour on ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
Now, if you've got some livestock, you might want to listen to this because a draft set of Australian standards for the design of livestock loading ramps has been released for public consultation. Their development was recommended by a Victorian coroner who investigated the death of a truck driver at a stall abattoir in October 2013. Their release comes as industry groups warn that unsuspecting farmers are still buying ramps which wouldn't comply with the new standards. Peter Somerville spoke to Standards Australia Head of Stakeholder Engagement, Daniel Tidgey.
So this standard was developed from a recommendation of a coronial inquest that focused on the tragic death of a transport worker while unloading livestock on a loading ramp. And what we've done is worked with the industry and developed a draft which is out for public comment now. And what we're doing is seeking the public and the farming community comment on the direction of the draft.
And tell me about this draft. What are some of the technical specifications or the design elements that are being incorporated here?
Yeah, so there's plenty in the standard, but some of the key details include guidelines that address the construction, inspection and the maintenance of the livestock ramps. This includes the gates, the latches and the chains. There's also guidance around the separation of the livestock and the livestock handlers. Also, there's guidance on supporting the structural integrity of the ramps.
And what will happen? Obviously, there's a lot of ramps and facilities out there that have already been built. Do these have to be retrofitted, or what's the path forward?
Yeah, it's a good question. It's important to note that standards on their own are voluntary documents. So they set out the specification procedures in guidelines, but in terms of implementation and whether it's a matter to be made mandatory, that's for the state and territory or federal government. So on their own, the standards are guidance documents.
What sort of a reaction has this received so far from industry?
So you could understand, due to the tragic circumstances surrounding the development of the standard, we have received significant support from industry in the development of the standard. Where we're at now is we're seeking feedback from the broader farming community to make sure that we're going down the right pathway.
And how many of these standards do we have for the agricultural industry? Is this a new thing, or are there a lot already in existence?
Yeah, so this is the first Australian standard that we've developed in this space, but I should say that we have aligned with pre-existing guidelines for the ramps and forcing yards, which was developed by the Australian Livestock and Rural Transporters Association. So there already has been some guidance in industry, and this draft aligns with that document, so hopefully will increase the safety of the workers in the livestock and strengthen the guidance that's ready in place.
Mick Debenham from the Livestock and Rural Transporters Association of Victoria says one of the key elements of the draft standard is separating workers and livestock.
For too long, people have been able to build whatever they like, and even if they want to try and build something right, they can't find anywhere to get that information. And we tried to do some work with that through the association with our Rams Guide, which was published in 2015, which was a good start. But it's not something that's really been taken, you know, a lot of notice of, particularly by people who need to enforce things when that needs to happen.
Why do you think people haven't seen the need for these standards?
To be honest, I think it's probably because the Work Health and Safety Authorities are probably used to going to stuff that's as robust as what a standard is.
Do you think that people will retrofit their equipment to bring it up to standard? Are you confident that that will happen?
Oh, I'd like to think so, yeah. But we're sort of hoping too that it'll stop people from selling stuff that doesn't meet the standard, you know, because a lot of people have spent money in good faith on loading ramps, thinking that they're buying something that's pretty good, but, you know, in reality they've bought something that's not that good at all and not safe.
So are some of the products that you sort of buy off the shelf on the market now, they wouldn't fit the standard, is that right?
Yeah, that's right. Particularly if they had price as a main driver when they go shopping.
That was Livestock and Rural Transporters Association of Victoria Joint Vice President Mick Debenham speaking there with Peter Somerville about some of the changes and things that people need to be aware of when it comes to loading ramps and the safety precautions that need to be taken when they are being built. You're listening to the Country Hour. We're going to catch up with John Tregar now, who has the results from the Dublin sheep sale.
Good afternoon. Quality continues to be extremely mixed, and while some extreme heavyweight older supplementary fed lambs were on offer, competition for these was not up to the previous week. Agents offered 6,000 lambs and 3,000 sheep to a full field of trade and processor buyers and a good field of restockers, with the overall result returning an erratic trend throughout the sale. Extremely light young lambs sold from 80 to 137. Lightweights received 122 to 152, with the few heavier weights making $182 to $200, with most sales improving by from $10 to $15 per head. Extremely light older lambs sold from 136 to 149. Lightweights received 130 to 170, with light trade weights selling from 146 to 186, returning an average $10 a head rise, as medium weights lifted $10 to $12 a head and received $180 to $210. Heavyweight supplementary fed types eased by from $15 to $20 per head, however, as they sold from $224 to $300 per head. Hoggets of mostly medium weights lifted up to $20 per head, receiving $178 to a sale top of $224 per head. Ewe mutton lifted another $10 to $15 a head this week, as lighter weights sold from $90 to $110. Medium weights received $152 to $192, with extreme heavyweights selling from $200 to $216 per head. More weather mutton was presented and sold from $10 to $20 dearer than the previous sale, as lightweights sold from $130 to $155. Medium weights received $154 to $226, with a large draft of heavyweights selling in runs from $210 to a top of $288 per head. Rams sold from $122 to $222 per head. This is John Traeger at the South Australian Livestock Exchange for LMLA's National Livestock Reporting Service and the Country Hour.
Thanks for that, John. Yeah, there's certainly been a lot of interest in livestock. I know that the Auctions Plus is, I think, has a record potentially of a number of listed cattle there. So there's a lot going on there in the livestock industry at the moment. You're listening to the Country Hour. It's coming up to 24 minutes past 12.
Yvonne Strahovski.
Hi. What's extraordinary?
Jai Courtney.
Your family, anyone know where you are?
Immigration detention, not a prison sentence.
Asha Keddy.
We just need to keep this away from the media.
Faisal Bazzi.
I am a refugee. I ask for a protection visa.
Marta Dusseldorf.
I think they've done something to my sister.
Dominic West.
You're not that person anymore.
And Kate Blanchett.
You found you, and you don't let anyone take that away.
Stateless starts this Sunday on ABC TV and iView.
You're listening to the Country Hour, and we will be finding out more about what's happened with Equinor and how South Australian industries have reacted to that in about 10 minutes or so. But now we'll find out what's happening in weather across South Australia. We're joined by Brett Gage. Hi, Brett.
Good afternoon.
So pretty clear skies by the looks of things. What's happening?
Yeah, it is fairly clear today. We've got a ridge of high pressure located over the south of the state, and that will move a bit northwards tonight, leaving us with a moist westerly airstream about southern coast, and so we might see a brief shower about the southwest of Kangaroo Island and the south of the lower southeast tonight, but conditions should be dry elsewhere. But there will be a weak front moving through the south of the state tomorrow morning, and that will extend a slight chance of showers across the southern agricultural area, reaching a medium chance about southern Fuliro Peninsula and the south of the lower southeast. And then those showers should clear during the afternoon. And associated with that front, there is a strong wind warning for the lower southeast coast, mostly south of Port Macdonald, for tomorrow. And the winds will freshen over inland parts during the afternoon, creating some areas of raised dust over the southeast of the northwest pastoral and also over the Flinders and northeast pastoral districts. Temperatures will be mild in the south, grading to very hot in the far north. Then behind that front on Thursday, we'll start to see a ridge of high pressure move in from the west. Just a slight chance of showers about southern coast on Thursday, and dry elsewhere. We'll see have moderate to fresh southwest to southeasterly winds, and cool to mild in the south, grading to warm to hot in the north. And then on Friday, there'll be a little bit of an increase in moisture, so we'll see a slight chance of showers around Gulf Coast and also about southern coasts and ranges. They'll be mostly in the morning, but a little increase in moisture there. And we're sticking to that southwest to southeasterly airstream. But there will be a high pressure system moving in south of the Bight on Friday, and that will move slowly eastward south of the state over the weekend. And that will bring dry conditions to the state during the weekend, apart from some early fog patches in the southeast. And temperatures will start warming up a bit, so it'll be warm to hot over most of the state by Sunday, grading to very hot in the far west. Now, our cumulative rainfall totals until the end of the weekend are generally going to be less than a millimetre where described, but possibly reaching 1 to 3 millimetres about the south of Fuliro Peninsula and also the south of the lower southeast. Then our further outlook on Monday and Tuesday is for dry conditions continuing on Monday and temperatures continuing to be very hot out in the far west and warm to hot elsewhere. And then on Tuesday we could see a little bit of moisture coming in from the eastern states. So we've got a slight chance of an afternoon shower or thunderstorm over the southeast districts, but continuing dry elsewhere and continuing to be warm to hot and very hot in the northwest. So, yeah, not a lot of rainfall on the horizon, but again, we're not expected to get very hot temperatures over the agricultural area, which is not a bad thing for this time of year.
It really is quite mild, isn't it? Is it particularly mild for this time of year normally?
Yeah, well, look, temperatures have generally been at least a couple of degrees below average for February. So, yes, it has been very mild in the south of the state. I guess most of us aren't too upset after the earlier parts of summer that we went through.
Exactly. It was shaping up to be pretty nasty temperature-wise, but it has backed off a little, which has been very welcome. Thanks for that, Brett.
You're welcome.
That's Brett Gage from the Weather Bureau. Just to the far west of New South Wales now, and it's going to be hot and mostly sunny in the upper western. There is a slight chance of a shower in the far east and some raised dust around, maybe even a thunderstorm. It'll get to 33 to 38. It'll also be mostly sunny and some raised dust in the lower western, and it will get to 27 to 33 degrees. This is the Country Hour, and it's coming up to 12:30.
You're listening to The Country Hour. For more stories from across the country, go to abc.net.au/rural. On ABC Radio Adelaide, South Australia and Broken Hill, this is Cassie Huff.
Hello, great to have your company today. As you heard in the news, the Norwegian oil drilling company Equinor has decided not to go ahead with drilling in the Great Australian Bight. We're going to hear how South Australia's mining and fishing industries have responded to that news. And South Australian women are a key part of the agriculture industry in this state. And today, about 200 women from across South Australia are in the Adelaide Hills for the 2020 Thriving Women Conference. We're going to take you there in about 10 minutes. First, though, we'll find out what's happening in news. We're joined by Wendy Glamachek. Hi, Wendy.
Yes, hi, Cassie. And as you've mentioned, fossil fuel company Equinor says its decision to pull out of the Great Australian Bight is purely a commercial move. The company advised federal politicians of its decision yesterday, saying the plan wasn't commercially competitive. The Green Senator Sarah Hanson-Young says the government should now permanently protect the Bight from such exploration plans in the future. Federal Labor, meanwhile, has echoed the federal government's disappointment over Equinor's decision. Losses continue on the Australian share market over coronavirus fears. It fell 2.3% at the open following steep falls around the world overnight. Travel company Webjet is among the hardest hit, down 7%. And the Home Affairs Minister says Australia faces foreign interference threats from a range of countries, not just China. The head of ASIO, Mike Burgess, has warned that foreign espionage and interference activities against Australia are higher now than at any time during the Cold War. We'll bring you more ABC News at 1 o'clock.
Thanks for that, Wendy. Yes, it certainly is big news for South Australia that the Norwegian company Equinor has pulled out, has decided to abandon its plans to drill for oil in the Great Australian Bight. I'd be interested in your thoughts on this. You can text in on 0467922891. The company Equinor said in a statement that its exploration drilling plan is not commercially competitive compared to other exploration opportunities. They were granted. The company was granted the first of several environmental approvals to drill as part of the Nullarbor coastline. But South Australian Chamber of Mines and Energy CEO Rebecca Knoll has reacted to the news, and she joins me now. Hi, Rebecca.
Yeah, good afternoon, Cassandra.
Are you disappointed by Equinor's decision?
Look, we're hugely disappointed for South Australians. This presented an amazing opportunity for South Australia, particularly at a time when the state is actively pursuing an ambitious 3% growth target. So it is disappointing for South Australians. In terms of Equinor, they've made a commercial decision and we respect that commercial decision.
Do you think this decision, though, has significance beyond just Equinor?
The decision has significance for South Australia to consider. We have a very healthy industry that is operating nationally. We have demonstrated, our sector has demonstrated that petroleum activities can occur safely and sustainably around our shoreline. Very recently we've had a well drilled deeper than the one proposed by Equinor in the Bass Strait, and the Bass Strait has been safely operating for more than 50 years. So from that perspective, yes, it's a bigger South Australian question as to whether or not we want activity in this state.
Because reading Equinor's statement, it sounds like it didn't stack up financially, and Chevron and the BP have also pulled out of drilling in the Bight as well. Do you think this could mark the end of exploration, given three companies now have decided it's not viable?
Three companies have also come up against extreme opposition, and most of that has been perpetuating fake news. So all three companies have had to deal with that in various degrees. And that certainly, that acceptance piece certainly weighs into any company's evaluation of a project. Curiously, that kind of opposition is not occurring in the Bass Strait or in Western Australian and other offshore waters. So it is peculiar to South Australia, and it is not the whole South Australian community that is opposed to drilling in the Great Australian Bight, because many educated South Australians know that it can be done safely and is being done safely all around the world, and particularly here in Australia.
Equinor did make it very clear in their statement that this was based on financial considerations, but how much of a role do you think that vocal opposition did play in the decision?
I think, again, I can't comment on behalf of Equinor. They've made a commercial decision not to pursue this opportunity in South Australia, but they have indicated that they will continue to pursue opportunities for their other licences in other parts of Australia. So I think it would be foolish to think that the campaign waged against the three companies, BP, Chevron and now Equinor, has not played into their assessment, their project assessment process. However, you know, what I really would like to commend Equinor on doing is actually opening up their environmental plan for community consultation ahead of regulatory submission. And this was a big step change and a welcome step change, and Equinor have been transparent with the community at every single point along this approval timeline.
There have been calls now to make the Great Australian Bight potentially a World Heritage Area. Do you think that will gain steam now that three companies have elected not to drill in the Bight?
The assessment of an area for World Heritage status needs to consider its current condition. We all know that the Great Australian Bight has been heavily impacted through agriculture, and particularly aquaculture, in past decades. So it is not a pristine environment, and that will no doubt be considered in any application for World Heritage status. Australia's oil production has fallen significantly over the past 10 years. We're now importing more than 80% of the oil we use. And again, this is a consideration for us as a state and us as a nation as to how much oil we want to import and whether we actually want to control our supply of oil, particularly as we have geopolitical circumstances that may it may assist us if we actually controlled our own supply, but that is something that this state and the nation needs to consider.
How much control would South Australia have had over a foreign-owned company like Equinor?
Because this well was to be drilled in federal waters, they are heavily regulated by the National Offshore Safety and Environmental Management Authority. So Australia retains significant control over any company drilling in our waters offshore, either whether they're state-based waters or federal waters.
But would it have actually made any difference to the amount of oil that Australia has access to?
Yes, in our understanding it would.
Are there any other companies looking to try and drill in the Bight?
There are other companies that hold tenement in the Bight and have been watching the Equinor process. I think any company that it has tenement in the Bight would continue to watch and see what is going on there. But yes, there is certainly the opportunity for any other companies to drill in the Bight, and we would maintain that, that this can be done safely.
Thank you so much for joining us.
That's all right. Thank you, Cassandra.
That was South Australian Chamber of Mines and Energy CEO Rebecca Knoll speaking there about this news that Equinor has decided to abandon its plans to drill for oil in the Great Australian Bight. I'm interested in what you think. You can text in on 0467 922 891. David has called in to say that this is a win for South Australia, the third large company to pull out of the Bight. He says we should all be celebrating. Speaking of someone who is potentially celebrating, I'm also joined by Kirsten Ruff, who is a researcher with the Southern Bluefin Tuna industry. Hi, Kirsten.
Hi, Cathy.
So what does your industry, the South Australia's tuna industry, make of this news?
We're very grateful for this announcement. Obviously, the risk of
developing oil in the Great Australian Bight has been something which has been hanging over our heads for some time now. Tuna is very much reliant on the Bight in its current state, and after 30 years of regulations on international fishing of the species, the stocks are rebuilding, so we are getting an increased quota, and this decision will actually underpin a bit of certainty on how we go about our investment plan for the next long-term years.
What is next, do you think, given that three companies have decided not to move ahead with the process? There are still companies that have tenements in the area, but what does this mean for the bluefin tuna industry?
Well, it means that we can consider in future investment. We are going to be getting quota increases out of the catch restrictions over the past 30 years. So how we go about in developing that opportunity so that we continue to underpin the regional economic development that we currently do. We employ over 980 people in Port Lincoln and contribute about $260 million to South Australian economy.
How would Equinor's plans, though, have affected that?
It's the risk and the uncertainty.
How much risk, given that the National Offshore Petroleum Safety and Environment Management Authority, or NOPSEMA, did accept Equinor's environmental plan for exploratory petroleum drilling? They still had a couple more approvals to get, but that didn't convince you?
Well, even in the environmental plan, which was accepted, Equinor just stated that they considered that there would be a long-term consequence for the southern bluefin tuna industry, with restitution times in excess of 10 years if anything went wrong or not to plan.
There has been calls now for the area to be World Heritage listed. That could impact on your industry as well. Do you support that?
I guess this is a discussion which we need to have. But fishing, one of the core qualities of the Bight is the diversity and the productivity of the area, and fishing is one of the features which sets the Bight apart from many other areas around Australia, the diversity of high-value fisheries.
And so beyond just tuna, there are a lot of fishing industries that take place in that area. I know you're specifically involved with tuna, but have you also spoken to other fishing industries like the oyster industry, abalone, industries like that?
Well, not directly this morning, because this is was a bit of a shock, actually. So it is something which we will do over the rest of the week.
Well, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
That was Kirsten Ruff. She is a researcher from the Southern Bluefin Tuna Industry, speaking there about this news. As she said, a bit of a shock that Equinor has come out to say that it is not going to go ahead with its plans to drill for oil in the Great Australian Bight. They've said that it's not commercially competitive compared with other exploration opportunities. But as we know, there has been quite a significant public opinion of people who don't want to see the drilling in the Bight, and as a result have protested against it. And I am interested in what you think this means for South Australia. You can text in on 0467 922 891.
This is the Country Hour on ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
Now going to go for a bit of a change of pace and head to the Adelaide Hills, because more than 200 women have met for the 2020 Thriving Women Conference. They've come from right across this state and also from Kangaroo Island, and Brooke Neindorf is there speaking with them. Hi, Brooke.
Hi, Cass. How are you going?
Well, thanks. So can you tell me through, what is Thriving Women 2020?
Yeah, so it's a conference here in Harndorf, and it's an absolutely stunning day here in Harndorf. They've been very lucky with their weather so far this week, but it's just about getting rural women together to be able to network and look at growing and inspiring women connected through agriculture.
So who's actually there?
Well, there is probably about 200 participants. There's probably about 185 women and about 15 men. There's not that many men here at all, but there has been a couple here. But there's lots of participants here at the 2 days at the Thriving Women Conference. And Cass, I've asked some of them to join me today. I'm actually going to get them to introduce themselves. So first up...
Hi everyone, I'm Jeanette Jallard. I live on Kangaroo Island and work both there and across Australia in my consulting business, which services the ag sector and with a big focus on women in ag.
Hello everyone, I'm Catherine Marriott. I live in Tumbarumba in the Snowy Mountains in New South Wales, and I am a rural community driver and advocate.
Hi, I'm Petey Rankin. I'm from a cattle station in between Cooper Petey and Glendambo. So I've come down for the conference. But yeah, I'm from up that way, about 8.5 hours north of here.
Well, Petey, we'll ask you first, how are things looking at the station at the moment?
Oh, I'm so glad you asked me that now and not a few months ago. So early this year or early Feb, we had 60 mil of rain, which is more than we've had in the last 2 years. So it is phenomenal. The grass up there is neon. It is just amazing. It is just, I just honestly, you just can't wipe the smile off our faces, because it was quite a strip where that weather went, and it seems to be the last 2 years we missed out on all of it, and just this strip just hit us, and it was just, and you ask people around us and they didn't get anything, and we were just so lucky, and we're just, it's nice to be able to enjoy that and not be the ones to say, oh, you got it again, we didn't. It's just so nice. It's amazing. We've got all our cattle home from that were on adjustment. They have come home. It is just, the kids are happy, the husband's happy, the dams are full, we can swim in them. It's amazing. It's amazing. Yeah.
Kathy, you're just smiling at that with Petey's descriptions there. You were here a couple of years ago for the last conference. What have you noticed as the difference here in SA?
Well, to start with, I couldn't wipe the smile off my face at Petey's smile on her face when she was just explaining that. Yeah, look, I think rain brings positivity. You know, you can't make money out of dust, you can make it out of mud. And coupled with that, obviously, where I come from, we've had massive bushfires. Jeanette has obviously is from Kangaroo Island, which was, you know, devastated by the bushfires. But I think one of the beautiful things about bringing a group of people together, and particularly women, I mean, honestly, it's like hens in a nest. Everyone just sort of feathers around and gets all excited and supportive, and it's an energy that you can't really replicate, I don't think, in any other setting. So, yeah, I feel really blessed to be here. There's always challenges, but with its opportunities, it's with which, through the frame which with you look to see it. And at the moment, we're all happy.
Jeanette and Kath just mentioned that being from KO, obviously that the bushfires are devastating over there the last couple of months. How are things around where you are?
Oh yeah, Kangaroo Island. It's taken quite a significant blow. It's quite interesting listening to Petey and Kath how much of our conversation is these days around weather and rain and no rain and now fires have been introduced to the vocabulary as well. Look. Kangaroo Island, like unfortunately so many communities around Australia at the moment, are just, you know, we're reeling from the bushfires. The impact has been significant. It's, you know, about, I think 40% of the island got burnt. We've lost properties, we've lost over 80 homes, farm businesses have been impacted, our tourism sector has been impacted. You can't actually go down the street and ask someone, you know, say, you know, have you been affected? It's actually more about how have you been affected? Because even people who perhaps didn't, you know, get flames on their place, the impact has just cut right across the community. So, you know, it's early days yet as far as the our recovery goes, and I have, you know, every confidence in our community to pull together, and we've already seen incredible signs of that. But it is going to be a recovery journey. I now really understand that word journey and how it goes with recovery, and I think we've probably taken the first step, but I think we've got many, many more to go.
As part of this conference, you also were looking to support women that had been affected by the recent bushfires, also obviously here in Cuddly Creek in the southeast as well. Has that been the opportunity been taken up?
Yeah, it has. We were really fortunate that we've had people sponsor some places here for the conference for women that are affected by the fire. So we've been able to support three women to come and participate. And I was talking to one of the recipients last night, and they were just so grateful. They said it's actually really good to get away and clear your head of space, because I know myself, when you're on the island, it's just there all the time. It's visually, it's there in the conversation, it's there. So to actually be able to come away and have a break from it, I think has certainly been important for her, and I'm sure it's been important to the other recipients of that support as well.
Isabella Pittaway will be on Kangaroo Island the next couple of days with the country out of here, more about the recovery process over there. But let's have a look at the conference now. The inaugural one was 2 years ago. Why was it so important, Jeanette, to have this again, this conference?
I think what we realised last time was just the gap that existed for women in agriculture and or connected, you know, to agriculture, to actually have space to hear about the topics that are important to them. And yes, you know, we have, it's still really important for lots of women to be able to go to the technical stuff and the production stuff, but there are so many other elements of being involved in the sector and being a woman in that sector that you don't necessarily get the opportunity to participate and attend things that service those needs. And that's, you know, we often refer to them, I like that in the past we've often referred to them as soft skills, but I actually think they're 21st century skills these days, because everyone now needs to be good communicators, they need to have leadership qualities, they need to be problem solvers, they need to be all of those things. And it's a conference like this that really provides women that opportunity to get those skills and knowledge and the confidence to actually be able to go back out and contribute to their industries. They do it anyway, but what we're really trying to do is give women, you know, that opportunity to build their capacity so they can be more influential where they want to be.
Petey, I'll just come back to you. What made you want to travel here to Harndorf and come to this conference?
So for me, obviously when it came out, we were still in the, you know, in the middle of a two-year drought, and it was devastating, and it was devastating everybody up there. And I just said outright, can't go. There's no way I can afford it. We've had Christmas, we've had a drought, we're going back to school, we've got a week in Port Augusta for school with the kids. Just can't do it. There's just no way. And I just put it behind me because I went, I can't do it. And then the South Australian Arid Lands Natural Resources Management, they said we're putting out a grant for five women in South Australia to go apply if you would like to. And I sort of said to my husband, should I? And he goes, well, what do you got to lose? Just, you know, if you get it, then we'll work it out. Then we can work out the kids and school and whatever, but just go for it. And I applied, and I was lucky enough to get it, because I just said to one of the ladies on the, like on the panel, I just said, I'm not trying to sway you, but if I don't get it, I won't go, because I can't afford to go. I can't afford to be away from home right now. So, you know, that's just how it is, and that's just the way it is up there. And that's okay. I was fine with that, and it was kind of good because the decision was taken out of my hands. If I'd got it, I'd come, and if I didn't, I wouldn't go. And then we got that rain, and then I got the grant, and I was like, oh, my God, the planets are aligning. Absolutely, I'm going. And I said to my husband, you can work out what you're going to do with the kids. I'll make some meals, but I'm going. And so, and it was just this, it was just like it was meant to be. And it just so happened that, you know, some of my very good friends are also here. And it's just, you know, to come and meet with like-minded women is just amazing. Like, and you all seem to be, like, it's the same, you know, we have the same goals and, you know, we're all just so similar and it's just so nice. But in the same way, you're meeting all these different women. Oh, it's just, it's phenomenal just to be able to connect with them and meet other people. And yeah, it's amazing. It's just not an opportunity that I would have got anywhere else. And certainly after speaking to some of the girls that came last, I'm like, make sure you try and get there. And I was like, right, I'm going to go. And it's in South Australia, and that does not happen often. Normally it's an interstate thing that we have to travel to. And I'm so proud to be a South Australian, and I'm just so proud that it's here. It's like, as if I'm not going to jump on that, because it is here. It's just kind of, it is 8 hours away, but it's still on my doorstep because it's, you know, it's not that far. So, yeah, absolutely. It's just the most amazing opportunity. So I'm very lucky to be here.
Kath, I'll come to you. You spoke yesterday to the crowd here at the Thriving Women Conference, and a lot of people come up to you afterwards and said, you know, thank you for your talk that you did, and it was really inspiring. And did you go out there to inspire the women, or what was your thoughts behind what you wanted to get across yesterday?
Yeah, look, in any speech that I ever give, I spend hours agonising about how I'm going to add value to the audience. You don't ever want to waste people's time or steal people's time, which is the way that I look at it. So yesterday I was asked to speak on courage, and I was really keen to ensure that the girls in the audience walked away with some tools so that they could step into their courage. Because I think, you know, women in ag are strong, they're resilient, they are stepping more and more into leadership roles, which I think is really exciting. And nothing gives me more pleasure than watching women stand beside men and the whole team moving forward together. I think we're better. The more diverse we are, the better we are. So I was lucky enough to speak to two incredible women, Sue Salthouse and Shanna Wong. I also spoke about my mum, who will kill me if she ever finds out that I think she's amazing, because she's like, "Oh, Missy, don't be silly. I just did what I did." But yeah, it's lovely when you are able to create a space for an opening in someone's mind to the possibilities. And I think courage is something, like, fear holds people back, courage overcomes fear, and when you're able to do that, you open up doors. And honestly, just nothing gives me, but it sounds really cliche, and nothing gives me more pleasure than people stepping into something they didn't think they could do, and then the smiles on their faces. So yeah, hopefully I've been able to light a wick in somebody, and rural Australia would be better off.
Just finally, here on the country, just let us know, what's have you taken away, just one specific thing that you've taken away from the conference over the last couple of days that maybe pricked up your ears or opened your eyes to something different that you'll take back home now and go, yep, I learnt that at Harndorf.
I think for me, it's having the confidence to be who I am in this industry, but I am me anyway. I'll just call a spade, but it's having the confidence, if I've got an idea, just because I am a woman, not that my husband is at all like that, but it, just in that industry, if I've got an idea, it's okay to bring it up. And I've got, you know, to have the strength within me to go, you know what, I can bring this up. And I think it's just given me the confidence, because I see all these women who are so amazingly successful, and I think, well, you started somewhere, so I can, and I don't want to be anywhere but on that property. But I can move forward, and I can still put into place the things that I would like to do, or my husband and I would like to do. So I think it's confidence for me, yeah.
And Kath, for you?
For me, it's pretty simple. I think rural and regional Australia is in pretty safe hands. I think it's as simple as that. We've got amazing women who've got amazing ideas. They've come here, they've shared them confidently, articulately, and I don't think there'll be one person that doesn't walk away from here with a gift to want to contribute more. So that's my takeaway.
And Jeanette, finally to you, as one of the co-conveners of the conference, what have you taken away from what's happened here at the Thriving Women Conference in Harndorf?
Well, I'd have to reiterate what Petey and Kath have said. One thing stuck with me yesterday. I went to a session by Dr. Kristen Alford from UniSA, and she was talking about futures. So she's a futurist. And she talked to us about thinking crazy, which I think we're kind of good at, but really embracing that craziness and being so preposterous that out of that, though, is where you're going to get your innovation. And I think that collectively as women, particularly last night over a couple of wines, we have the opportunity to be really preposterous, think of those crazy ideas, and then take the gems out of it that are really going to help drive rural and regional Australia forward, and it rests with us.
That's exactly right. Well, Cass, that is all we've got time for here at the Thriving Women's Conference in Harndorf. I better let these ladies get back to the next sort of workshops that are coming up after the lunch break here. Jeanette Gellard, Kath Marriott, Petey Rankin, thank you very much for joining us here on the Country Hour today.
Thank you.
And Cass, that's back to you in the studio.
Thanks for that, Brooks. Some great comments there by some women in South Australian agriculture. I'm sure there were some great connections and work will come from that event. It is 1:03.
You're listening to The Country Hour on ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
And we've been talking about the Norwegian company Equinor's decision to abandon its plans to drill for oil in the Great Australian Bight. The company said that exploration drilling plan is not commercially competitive compared to other exploration opportunities. We've had a caller from Port Lincoln say that all of the activities that do take place on the Eyre Peninsula are complementary, like fishing and tourism and agriculture, whereas oil is a risk. It's not complementary, and that is why the industry over there is not supporting Equinor's plans to drill. But as we know, they've decided not to. So you can keep your thoughts coming. You can text in on 0467922891. We'll find out what Sonia Feldhoff has up on her program. Hi, Sonia.
Hello, Cassie. Well, indeed, we will be going to the community on the West Coast to find out more about the varying reactions to that decision by Equinor today. That will be after two. But before then, blue-ringed octopuses are appearing on Adelaide beaches. Now, this isn't a new thing. They have been there before, but there are numerous sightings of them and have been over recent weeks. And I know that they're located in some places on the York Peninsula at various times. So we're going to talk about what you do if you come across a blue-ringed octopus, certainly in greater numbers than we experience.
I've never seen one.
No, I've never seen one. And in my mind, they're things that you see in Queensland.
Yeah, true.
But here in Adelaide, apparently.
Wow. Well, I learned something new. That's why you got to listen in to Sonia.
And in just a moment too, have you checked the footpaths around your place recently? There is an audit being done around our council areas. How do they do it? What are they looking for? We'll tell you.
Well, I hope they're after cracks, because I could do with some of the cracks around my
tripping hazards.
Yeah,
as you
exactly.
get older, Cassie. Yeah, that's right.
Thanks for that, Sonia. That's all we have time for in the program today. It's coming up to 1 o'clock. Time for news.
Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.